Welcome to the CMO Marketing Podcast, where we interview business owners, leaders, or marketing professionals to find out their lessons and stories for success.
Welcome to the CMO Marketing Podcast with me, your host, Simon Dell. Thank you for joining us again. As usual, we've got a fantastic guest on today to talk about all things marketing. But before we jump into that, just the usual announcements. If you want to find out a little bit about CMOH, there it is on my hat, CEMOH.com. We are marketing staff on demand. We're the marketplace for marketing people. Forgot my own tagline there for a moment. We basically hire out high quality marketing people by the day, the week, or the month, or however long that you need them. If you want to catch up for me, I'm on LinkedIn. You can email me at simon@cmoh.com. Pretty much find me on any other social platform. And finally, if you get the chance, please rate and review us on iTunes or any other platform that you listen to us on. We're also on Spotify, Google Play, all sorts of other podcast places and things like that. Please go in there, give us a review. Ideally, give us 5 stars and say something nice, but you can be honest if you like, whatever you want to say. With me today is a gentleman by the name of Andrew Borg, who has a fantastic history of agency and client marketing work with some very... Here we go. I'm going to make a joke here. High caliber companies. Boom, chish. There we go. Welcome to the show, Andrew Borg.
Happy to be here, mate. Thank you.
And of course, explain to everyone why my little joke was so pertinent there, because you currently work for a company called High Caliber, right?
That is right. So I've been with High Caliber for nearly 6 months now. Very different sort of role to what I've had in the past, but exciting nonetheless.
Explain to us what High Caliber do and what it is that you actually do there.
Right. So High Caliber has traditionally been software and web development, very custom sort of stuff. What I've brought into that now is more of that marketing nurture angle of using data. So first party data. So it's helping brands, companies, marketers make better use of their first party data and use that marketing technology element to instigate that.
Yeah. So I'll tell you what, let's just jump straight into a question there about data, because that's obviously, you know, that's been a big thing in the last 10 years.
Yeah, it's big data. Now, big data.
Yeah, look, we're pretty much as marketers exposed to this, you know, knowing your data stuff all the time. Do you think we're getting any better at analyzing data, or we're getting worse at it, or is it just that there's too much data, we don't know where to look? What's your sort of take on that whole thing?
Look, having worked in a lot of different industries now, so I guess I worked at City Beach for a while, e-commerce, fast fashion, and that moves so fast that you don't have the time to really analyze the data, because you're literally changing your promotion week to week. And it's just what margin erosion promotion are we running this week, you know? And so that's how you're doing it. You're looking at the dollars and seeing if they're coming in, and less about analyzing the data. Then I went and worked at GJ Gardner Homes, where you've gone from having selling board shorts for $80 to $1 million homes with a consideration period of like 2 years. Right. So you've got more time to look at the data and analyze it. Problem with the property industry is that they're still living in, you know, the early 2000s, and most of their marketing things, you know, aren't aligned to that digital stuff. So I had a lot of fun at GJ's analyzing that data, but I was still pushing shit up a hill a lot of the time, because the people around me weren't really buying into it. They didn't really understand. They didn't trust the data. So there's a lot of trust issues happening out there. That's where I'm, I guess, trying to sort of pioneer that, and with all the interactions I have, just better explain your data. And it can just be as simple as where's your traffic coming from? You know, it's that level of data. Then you've got your persona data of, you know, what do we know about these people? How can we segment these audiences, and what can we talk to them about? I think the big promise of big data was that we were, as consumers, always going to be marketed things of relevance. And that's just not happening. And I think that's just bad marketing. There's lots of bad marketing happening out there. You go onto any social feed and you're like, why am I seeing this? And because you feel that way, you just skim past it. So all that brand work that's happening in the background is being misused because you're not aligning it to the right audience.
I had a great conversation with a prospect client last week who just started doing radio ads. And they've been doing radio ads, I think, on Nova for the past two and a half months, something like that. And the first question they said to me is, we don't know whether it's working. I sort of opened up Google Analytics in front of them, and I sort of said, look, let's have a look at your direct traffic in the last, across the last 6 months, right? And you could see a correlation from when the Nova ads had started to maybe about a week, 2 weeks later, this kind of impact of their direct traffic. So people typing their URL straight into their browser, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I said, there you go. You can see this correlation. There's clearly a change in direct traffic. You know, there's obviously a change in the search traffic as well. You could see this trend, but that's probably as good as it was a trend. I couldn't sit there and say that was all absolutely to do with Nova, or that was all absolutely to do with the billboard. You're still, to a degree, and I find, and you know, interested in your opinion, you still find to a degree there's a little bit of guesswork out there, which I guess is where you then get this trust issue from.
There is. And what I found with the radio experience personally was that the people wanting to do radio were making decisions based on their experience. And so they picked a radio station because that's what they listened to. And they liked hearing their brand message on there. And you can't really compete with that. You know, like that's what you can show them all the data in the world, but if it makes them feel better to do it and they've got the bandwidth to do it, so be it. And radio is power. Like, I think all marketing channels have a superpower, but a lot of them aren't used to exploit that. You know, it's just, you're just running radio ads. But, you know, I guess for me, it's looking at, well, how much did you spend on those radio ads over that period of time? This is the uplift we can see. If we spent it differently, could we get a different result? Because for me, my how I start any conversation about marketing is, what does success look like?
Yeah.
You know, and for them in radio, it's like, well, we just want brand awareness. Great. Yeah. You're pushing that out there. Then you can start really analyzing whether or not the creative is what is working in that space. You know, is it catchy enough? Is it impactful? Do people even remember the brand after they've heard it?
Mm. And it's interesting because I was trying to compare. I mean, I'm not a radio fan. Never have been. Never really see. You know, if you're in radio, I get where, how you sell the benefits or what you think the benefits are. But I was trying to compare radio to Google Ads. And actually, by the end of it, I'd actually convinced myself that the radio was doing a better job than the Google Ads was. Probably because the Google Ads wasn't refined enough. It was very much going, you know, here's 20 search terms. Let's just throw them at wall and see what sticks. And they were just getting a lot of junk searches and things like that. But, you know, even for me, I could see that the direct traffic, that those visiting a website through direct traffic were hanging around on that site three times as long as those coming through Google Ads, which said to me that it was a much more engaged, you know, engaged traffic. But I can completely understand your perspective from the trust, because you put this in front of a client and they just don't believe the numbers that they see in front of them sometimes, do they?
Yeah, and look, the traditional media, if that's what we're still calling it out there, like, it'll always have that advantage, I think. You know, like, who is watching free-to-air TV? Like, I have not had my antenna plugged in for the better part of 6 or 7 years now. Mm. And yet there are still brands spending billions of dollars collectively on free-to-air TV to be there.
A perfect example is the Budget Direct ads, right? With the guy in the raincoat who's the detective or private investigator or whatever it is, every single billboard I see for a Budget Direct ad or a bus that I saw the other day has his face or some connotate some part of the story that they're trying to tell with this guy. But unless you'd watched the original fucking TV advert, none of it makes a piece of sense to you. So I'm seeing these billboards and buses going, I don't know what any of this means because I've never seen the original TVC.
And it would be fascinating to know what the sort of data analysis is happening over there at Budget Direct to determine whether or not this creative angle is working or not. Because a lot of the time it's like, well, my insurance is up for renewal, depending on how big a jump they want to try and scalp you with. And, you know, oh, we've increased it 20% because it always goes up. It doesn't matter what it is. It might have nothing to do at all with the brand because they might just do a search. You go to compare the market and Budget Direct's the best one on there. You know, like it's so difficult to measure in some ways. And I guess it's the marketing, the heads of marketing in these organizations are the one that are using their own preference to steer it. And that's been obvious for many years.
Or do you think, I'm not saying you're wrong, or do you think it's those agency people, because you come from that agency background.
Yeah.
Do you think it's those agency people who are protecting their client account so much that they are literally in there massaging the figures to show the Budget Directs of this world, hey, look, this TVC that we've run is, look at the effect, look at the uplift that we've produced because of this. When you go out and ask 9 out of 10 people who've got no idea who the dude in the raincoat is.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, 100%, you know, it's, you're being steered to, you know, by your, and this is where you've got to walk that fine line between friendship and working relationships with your agency people, because they'll always have the great tickets and the whining and dining, and Christmas time, yeah, you'll always get something sent to you, and that relationship building will never go away. It's yeah, it's paramount to it. But, yeah, you know, like I had a great example at GJ's. We launched a new campaign, right? And it was designed for a digital execution. It was a long, it was a 90-second ad. It was always designed for YouTube. And it was designed to just target people in market, right? So we ran it on YouTube. We did programmatic. The results that we could see were amazing. But to all the franchisees at GJ's, they hadn't seen it because they're not searching for these things. And it was just like it wasn't happening. Yeah. And so despite the fact that you can show them on YouTube, we have an 85% view-through rate of a 90-second ad, which is just unheard of. That was completely missed. And yeah, it was just, well, we want to put it on TV. So, well, it's not really designed for TV. The shorter versions of it rely on you seeing the other one.
Yeah.
And we're not talking to the mass audiences. We're talking to a very niche group of people that are in a position to want to build a home.
Yeah.
And so the mass market of just, who are you talking to? It's a very small, and I used to do this analogy of like, in your local area, consider it's a pizza. And the olives on that pizza represent the people in market looking at a house or looking at whatever you want. But if you pick radio or TV, you're just looking at one little slice of that pizza and however many olives are on that slice, right? So that's who you're talking to. Whereas with digital, and you're doing this nurture-based thing where you're basically targeting people based on search relevance, you've got the whole pizza to play with. And you could use the same budget to do both. So that kind of analogy did cut through a little bit, but it still came down to people want to see themselves. And we've all heard those stories about setting up the billboard outside the CEO's drive to work and, you know, just, yeah, this is great, I'm loving it. And then they just leave you alone for the next 6 months because they think that something's happening out there. Yeah. But will that ever change? Probably not.
I want to sort of jump and talk about your e-commerce experience with City Beach, because you were there a good couple, 2-3 years. And we don't have time to sort of delve directly into it. I just want to get your thoughts for people that run e-commerce businesses, be they big or small. What are some of the tweaks or things that you guys might have done in the e-commerce business there at City Beach to, you know, increase conversion rates, or, you know, what are some of the tricks that you might have learned in the trade there?
The big moment was implementing nurture-based email marketing, you know, right, that was really just tracking the individual, looking at their cart or abandoned cart, and then remarketing to them accordingly. When I first started there, it was pretty small, the sort of budgets that they were spending monthly, and then we increased those probably about 20 times to be the standard monthly investment. And again, right, this was a privately owned company that, you know, this guy that was running it was still trying to understand digital himself. So it was his money too. You know, we didn't have budgets. You know, he would basically, you'd have to go and pitch to him why you need to do something, which, you know, that was daunting at the same time. And it was exhilarating when you got that win.
Yeah.
But it was the unlocking of nurture that really saw us go there. So we went over to the US and went to a conference over there called Ita West. And there's a brand over there called Fabletics. It's part owned by Kate Hudson in the fashion space. And the stuff that they were doing to nurture and customize and personalize the experience was just phenomenal. Like, you would sign up and give all your details about who you are. So if you're an African-American woman that is a size 16, you would enter all that in. You put your favorite colors in there, and then everything that you are, your experience is just seeing a woman like that. And so you're seeing what's happening out there and that the results of what they were doing. And it was just like, wow, this is mind-boggling. And it's that level of personalization that I think unlocked what we were doing at City Beach.
Was there other things like, I mean, one of the things that's always fascinated me with fashion-based e-commerce like that is the photography. Does that make a difference? Do you find that, you know, putting videos in that, in where the products are and having all those, does that make a difference? Or just does a picture of a pair of board shorts, is that good enough?
I think that because like it was staggering, like when you look at the life cycle of a product, it was like 6 weeks. It
Right.
goes from full price to it's reduced to clear, you know,
Right.
6 weeks. So you're more about building a conversation about your brand. Those little things in there aren't converting necessarily on a major scale that you can actually measure, but it's the ongoing experience of that. Like they might just see that a girl twirling in a dress, or your social media feed is full of, you know, combination of models and real people, and lifestyle shots and all that sort of thing. It's adding to that brand experience. Whether or not one particular thing was, you know, converting higher than other, it's almost impossible to sort of gauge.
Right.
But we also had like the brand was fascinating in that it had such a bizarre audience of, you know, who is your persona? Because initially it was like, well, who do you think your audience is? And these like 16 to 24-year-old girls.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, no, that the data didn't reflect that. It's actually, you know, a 30 to 42-year-old woman. Because she was once 16 to 24, and that's when you cemented your brand in her head, and she has never
Yeah.
left you. And she's been the primary, you know, source of your income for the last 10, 15 years.
Yeah, I have to say, from moving when I sort of first moved to Australia 20 years ago, I would have been in my late 20s there. That city beach, you've got a good, probably there was a good 5, 6 years there when I first sort of came in, where city beach was my go-to for, thongs and boardies and t-shirts
Yeah.
and vests and all those kind of things, because you have the disposable income to make that purchase.
Oh, it's a great brand. It's a great brand, and it's a different experience. It doesn't follow the usual retail conventions in store. Like it's a bit of a you gotta put some time aside to go on a city beach because you gotta have a dig. You know, it's not just all clean laid out. It's there's lots of stuff, a lot of things to be hidden and found. But I think that, you know, the curse of retail in fast fashion prevents retail brands from actually evolving their story because they're constantly on sale and on promotion every single week. It doesn't allow those kinds of brands to actually create a dedicated story as to why I'm affiliating myself with this brand. I'll only shop at City Beach, or I'll only shop here, or I'll only shop there. Like it's very difficult to do that. So the consumer just, well, I know what City Beach sells. So if I want a pair of Vans, I could go to City Beach, but I could also go to Universal Store. I could go to Surf Time and Ski. I could go to any sort of shoe shop and get them. They're all going to be the same price too. So I decide based on my brand experience who I'm going to buy it from. So, you know, it's a tough one out there for fast fashion.
You move from agency to client side. Why make that change?
A lot of the people I was up against in agency side was I started a bit later. I didn't really I started uni later. I didn't get out of uni until I was, you know, probably about 4 years older than most of the other grads coming in. And I never really found my stride. I couldn't break into the big agencies at the time. I graduated in, you know, GFC. No one was putting any grads on for jobs. There was no money going around. And so I had to hustle and work and go through all these smaller agencies, and they were all different kinds. So I was just started. I'd do like 12 months in an agency, and it'd be like, oh, we're a creative agency. So you're working with designers, and you learn that. And then I would evaluate it and go, am I going to do the same thing next year, or is there going to be anything different on the horizon? And 9 times out of 10, it was no. Nah, it's the same clients wanting to do the same thing, rinse and repeat. So doing 2 years there is basically the same as one. So I would jump. And then I would go to a web development agency or a media buying agency. And I was just chipping away under the banner of account management, learning how all of these different specialists work. And I think it occurred to me a bit later on that it's like there's a few more different disciplines I need to better understand, and then I'll jump client side. Getting the job at City Beach was a bit of a fluke, to be honest. They had that job going for about 6 months. They couldn't find anybody, and I think I was just the right place at the right time. It was a 4-hour interview. You know, like I just stayed there, and they kept bringing people in to come and meet me because they were like, hey, yeah, he's all right. Yeah, get the next person in, because they just wanted it done. They just wanted someone in the job to do it. I found out later that I was replacing the owner's son. So that was, and I didn't know about that until about 2 months into the gig.
Was he leaving willingly, or was he leaving kicking and screaming?
He was a great guy. He actually went, and I have a lot of respect for him. He actually went overseas. He went to the US, and he wanted to make his own name for himself. He didn't want to just live under there. So you did a lot of great stuff over there. But, you know, it's like anyone, that nepotism stuff. You're always going to be your father's son. Yeah, so when I made that jump and got across to that, you know, I found, and that was part of the reason I got that gig, was that I had agency experience. So it was knowing how to wrangle agencies. And that's what really kicked me off into it. But I loved being able to dabble in all these different things. I don't think I'm the sort of person that could say, I'm going to commit myself to email marketing. Or I'm going to commit myself to media buying. I just think it would be too limiting, because I like solving problems.
Yeah.
And I want to be able to pivot and move. And if it, the jump is that we actually need to do a radio campaign, well, I could do that because I've had experience in that space. Yeah. And that was the genesis for it. And I think that that's sort of dying away in people's careers at the moment, because, you know, you've got a Gen Z that gets out of uni and then within 3 years they're a senior marketer. And they have one discipline and they've been given six figures and they're stuck in that thing of like, well, I don't want to give up the money, right? But they also not going to grow their experience because they're in one swim lane. And so finding these well-rounded marketers, you know, it's more of a slower play. You've got to be prepared to work for next to nothing, get treated like shit for a long time, and then come out the other end of it more resilient to be able to solve problems.
Do you think the agency model as it stands at the moment is outdated? Do you think it's and if so, well, if yes or no, but how would you improve it?
I don't know that it's outdated. I think that the game has changed and it's trying to use the old model of traditional media buying and this, you've got this time. There's so many specialists involved in marketing these days, and trying to apply the old model, which was, it's all about the commercials. You know, you're trying to lure the best talent, which means you're going to have to be paying them six figures, right? And junior people get poached. You spend all your time breeding them up to be a great team player, and then they just get nipped and go somewhere else and earn a bit more money. And that's just going to keep repeating. You know, I think in Australia, particularly since we've had borders closed and we haven't had all these POMs coming over to, you know, do a stint in Oz and fall in love with it and help sort of just lower the wages a little bit because they're willing to work for a bit less. Like, that's definitely had an effect. But I think that, you know, even just the way the next generation thinks and work, like, I see them as so self-absorbed. You know, like, I've seen Gen Zs that their solution to everything is TikTok. Who's the audience? You know, who are we talking to? You know, they're not on TikTok. You know, you're not looking at the data. You're not looking at the problems. So, yeah, I definitely think it's not working. And at the same time, I don't know how you would fix it. I think that there's probably not going to be big agencies, you know, or if there are big agencies, they're just lots of pods of smaller teams that work on accounts together, because that's how you're going to get the best results.
You've obviously come across a lot of good pieces of marketing technology. What are you using now? What are your favorite bits and pieces? What's your go-to for, you know, making your life a bit easier?
Oh, I'm absolutely in love with HubSpot at the moment. We're pushing that to all of our clients at the moment. It's just, I think people have dabbled in HubSpot maybe 5 years ago and they're like, yeah. But it has changed so much since then. Like, the ability to nurture and create workflows and segments and talk to your audience through there. Like, I'm such an advocate of first party data, because you spend all this money to get people's contact information and then they're not doing anything with it, right? So you've paid all this money to get, and then you're still running all these paid ads to get those same people to come back, whereas you've got this permission to talk to them. And it's the power of a tool like HubSpot that can really allow you to better understand that and deep dive into it. It is a bit of a beast. It does require a lot of attention to detail, and, you know, you need specialists to get in there and do it. But I think if you're to really assess where you're spending your money in the marketplace, and you were to just retool and put some different players involved, like, you'll get a way better long-term return on investment there. We're applying that at the moment to the real estate business, the real estate sector. You know, this has been an area that really just REA, realestate.com, has just dominated for so long that, you know, the real estate sector doesn't even, that is marketing. I don't really need a website. That's just more of a doormat for my brand. I'll just get all my leads from REA. And at the same time, they're collecting all this first party data, you know, and they're selling one product. So you might get 50 people inquire about a house and one person buys it. So what are you doing with the other 49? You know they're in market. You know what suburb they're interested in and what sort of house. If you were to be able to, you know, enrich in that data and keep them on the hook, they'll come to you the next time.
Yeah.
And the barrier for that has been that, you know, HubSpot doesn't integrate with CRMs that are in the real estate business. And so, but the real estate CRMs don't have that nurture-based capabilities. So Hicaliber, we've built a middleware solution that talks to both and can feed your data to both of them. So it's called Malcolm. So Malcolm in the middle. It's the middleware piece. And that's unlocking that potential to allow us to have a better experience as consumers in the real estate game, you know?
Yeah. And just for your point there, I was looking at HubSpot whilst you were talking. HubSpot, if you want to pay monthly, if you're not prepared to commit annually, and you're a small business, the starting price is $75 a month. And I think for a, you know, for any business that's serious about their marketing, they're serious about automation and all those kind of things, spending $75 a month is tiny compared to what you get for it.
It is. And you know, there's so many videos on YouTube. There's people have created entire businesses just building content on helping people solve problems on HubSpot. It's an out-of-the-box solution that if you've got the bandwidth and time, or you can, you know, just say, look, this is what you're doing now to one of your people on your team, it will pay dividends in the end. And it's the reporting component to give you insight as to what's going on out there.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what's got me really excited at the moment. And that's what we're building a whole arm of our business to service that, because we can just see that there's a gap in the market for it.
Mate, thank you very much for your time today. If anybody wants to reach out to you, where's the best place for them to find you and talk to you?
Yeah, just give me a buzz on LinkedIn. I'm just the bald guy with the beard on LinkedIn, Andrew Borg. There's probably a lot of them out there. All those hi to the Maltese folk that know that Borg is like Smith in Malta.
You must get a few Star Trek references over your years, yeah?
Look, there's three types of people I meet. There's Maltese people that know Borg. Right. There's Trekkies that know it from that. And then there's tennis people. So your Bjorn Borgs and you know, all that sort of thing. So it reveals a lot. But yeah, the Trekkie one's weird because it's not something that people like to brag about. They're a Star Trek fan, but then they reveal themselves quite quickly with me. But
yeah, we come out of the woodwork very slowly. But
anyway. Yeah, look me up on LinkedIn. Look up Hicaliber. You can find us that way.
Sounds good, mate. Thank you very much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure and very insightful. So thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, brother. Cheers.